This is Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This hour, we bring you stories of how sea level rise affects South Florida, how we are navigating the issue, and action that is being taken in response to it. But let's start on the shoreline.
It's most evident here on Purdy Avenue, this area, this was all really filled in so that people could be here. There was no way to live here when they first came to try and make a city. So when they built it, they didn't build it up especially high, and if we stand here, we can look uphill toward the beach. So it's high tide right now, so as we look in the grate, you can see the water is only about 2 inches below the bottom of the grate. So if we were to have a heavy rain right now and get 3 or 4 inches of water trying to go into that sewer right there, it's not going in there, so it would flood the street.
Brian of Miami Beach is taking us on a tour of his neighborhood, Sunset Harbor. He's lived in and around Miami for about 2 decades. What he sees in his neighborhood is typical of residents of Miami Beach and other low-lying coastal areas in South Florida.
And we can see the old businesses are really right at street level, and water comes in those buildings. The new businesses, they built this big new parking garage here, and not only did they raise it up, they also have flood walls that go in front of all of the doors there that bolt to the front of that, so that they're taking a modest step toward protecting themselves against the wake of cars that come through when the street is flooded. Since you close your business, you put up your flood barrier, and you wait for the flooding to go down. You can see the vegetation in the islands here, and all along the sides are all burned. That's from the salt from the water that comes up in here, and then cars come along and splash it over into the vegetation. So the only thing living there and living well are plants that are more salt resistant. You see, the streets are broken. The asphalt is broken. The fact that the paved street is really in a flood zone, it was never made to contain water.
Now listen to what he says. Listen how he's saying it. You may recognize Brian's voice. He is a fixture of Miami's meteorological history.
Team coverage begins now with meteorologist Brian Norcross.
Okay, Jose, a hurricane watch means that hurricane conditions are possible within the next 24 to 36 hours here in South Florida, as a matter of fact, all along the southeast Florida coast.
Brian Norcross, he was instrumental in getting vital information to South Floridians throughout Hurricane Andrew back in August of 1992. Norcross knows something about having to see something in order to react. Many residents failed to take Andrew seriously back then, putting lives at risk until it was too late. Rising seas has no face like Andrew. It's a slow, changing process, and the time frame that sea level rise works on opens up a lot of room for variables and uncertainty. One of the challenges with sea level rise, like with the paths of hurricanes, is pinning down the prediction. We're all familiar with the map of a storm track and the forecast route, the cone of uncertainty. It's the possible path of a storm. The farther out, the larger the range of options. For sea level rise, farther out is the end of this century. The cone gets pretty wide way out there. It's as far as many forecasting models project. Reporter Kenny Malone takes us through predictions and asks a very simple question.
In the year 2100, how high will the sea level have risen?
1.6 to 4.6 feet.
Okay. So that's it.
Yup. According to the National Research Council.
I respectfully disagree. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says 0.65 to 4.9 feet.
Okay. Anybody else?
0.7 to 6.6 feet.
Okay. Down computer voices. Let's start from square one here.
Sea level rise consists of two components.
David Enfield is a climatologist with the University of Miami and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That first component
is the heating of the ocean.
As the climate warms, the oceans warm, the water expands, and sea level rises. The existing models do a relatively good job projecting that effect.
And the other is the disappearance of landlocked ice.
Again, as the climate warms, landlocked ice sheets start to melt. Water goes into the ocean, sea level rises. Scientists are watching two gigantic ice sheets in particular.
Greenland and Antarctica.
This is where projections start to diverge wildly. Based on what Enfield's seen, for example, he says sea level rise in 2100 will be at least 2 feet, possibly 3, But if ice sheets wind up melting faster than we've been seeing already,
we could be seeing 6 feet by the end of the century.
A 6-foot sea level rise puts the majority of Miami-Dade County below sea level. But that's Enfield's very unlikely scenario. Harold Wanless, on the other hand?
6 to 20 feet, somewhere in there.
6 to 20 feet. That's like water world for South Florida. Wanless is a geologist at the University of Miami, and he says if you look at the past, sea level rise happened in rapid, catastrophic leaps.
They're barrier islands, just like the ones today, left on the seafloor, just left there.
Wanless says past sea level rise shot up because somewhere an ice sheet collapsed suddenly, and he thinks we're starting to see that again. At this point, though, ice sheet melt effect isn't really built into the climate change models. It's more or less tacked on using expert judgment. That's part of why you get expert projections that span anywhere from
2 feet
to 20 feet.
They're personal takes on the science. But some of the highest profile projections don't come from a single voice.
We more or less agree, 0.8 to 3.2 feet.
That's the latest projection from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, 0.8 to 3.2 feet.
The role of the IPCC is to do an assessment of the state of the literature, not to actually produce new science.
Ronald Stauffer works at NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab in Princeton, New Jersey.
I study past, present, and future climates.
Stauffer co-authored 4 of the IPCC's 5 reports. The panel's made up of hundreds of experts from dozens of countries that discuss what models to use, what papers to believe, and how to make sense of it all. The IPCC catches flack from both ends of the spectrum. Many say their numbers are too conservative. Others have said they overstate the problem. Stauffer says,
it's the nature of the game, right? When you're making a consensus, you're trying to hit that middle.
Many of the projections you'll see emerge from groups of experts like the IPCC. And even those groups don't necessarily agree. For example, here's the projection from NOAA's National Climate Assessment.
8 inches to 6.6 feet.
The projection from the International Scientific Congress on Climate Change.
1.6 to 4.9 feet.
And the projection from the Miami-Dade Climate Change Advisory Task Force.
3 to 5 feet.
And so back to our question. What will sea level rise be in 2100? Simple answer. Somewhere between
1.6 to 4.9 feet.
So, Kenny, you start with a very simple and appropriate question, but you wind up with no definitive answer. Very challenging.
Right, yeah.
Frustrating.
A little frustrating.
How do we think about it?
So I talked to 2 experts in particular that I think came up with good ways to start thinking about this. And I actually brought a prop along to help with the first one. Ready?
All right.
So I have...
What do you got there? Some dice.
I got a couple of dice.
All right.
I'm gonna rattle them on mic. We're going to explain, this will make sense in a second. The first expert is Ben Kurtman, who's a professor of meteorology and physical oceanography at the University of Miami. And he says he goes to cocktail parties and people ask him about this very uncertainty thing.
It's going to be, you know, I'm gesturing with my hands on the radio, so it's probably not too useful. But the best way that I know to explain uncertainty is to talk to someone about playing craps with loaded dice.
Loaded dice. So I've got dice here. If you don't know what loaded dice is, it's basically the idea is that you put little weights into the dice so that a fair die turns into a die that favors one number over time. It doesn't happen every time you roll, otherwise it would be too obvious. But if you know about this,
you're turning the odds into your favor.
Into
with
your
loaded
favor.
Die.
And if you know about it, you can play that to your advantage.
So if I knew 7 was going to come up more than it should, I would just standing bet on 7, and then I'd, you know, go to the bar.
And there's no doubt, no one doubts that loaded dice is cheating, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you knew the dice were loaded and you bet against it, you would be insane because over the long run, you would lose. And so what Kurtman says is that if you knew that sea level was rising, maybe they can't give you an exact number, and maybe, you know, next year it doesn't rise as much as they had predicted. But still, if you bet against sea level rise in the long term, you will lose.
And that's the point I always want to make, is that it's crazy to ignore it in our calculation. But I don't know what your calculus is. I don't know what your cost-benefit analysis is. So that's why I don't get into policy, because I don't know what these things cost. But what I can say is it's crazy not to include it in the calculation.
All right, Kenny. So the dice are loaded. We'd be crazy to bet against it. In other words, to not plan for rising sea level. So how do we take it into account?
Right. And so you hear Kurtman talk about those calculations, right? And so the next expert that I want to play sound bites from, his name is Obi. I'm not even gonna try to say his full name.
Yeah, Jayanta Obisekara. Everybody calls me Obi.
So we'll go ahead and call him Obi too. Right. But Obi is the chief modeler for the South Florida Water Management District, and he's one of the most important guys trying to take sea level rise into account when making calculations for future projects. And so when it comes to uncertainty, he advocates for a scenario-based approach, which he says we as people, we deal with all the time.
For example, when you're planning, let's say, next couple of weeks from now, do you plan for that it's going to be raining for sure? Or do you plan for the possibility it's going to be cloudy, or it could rain, or it could be sunny?
And so we've seen this. We've seen a variation of different, like, it's going to be a 5% chance it's going to rain next week, or maybe you see a 20% chance. And you as a person take that into account differently based on, let's say, you're going to wear your nicest suit during that week. Well, you're probably going to take whatever chance of rain there is more seriously than if you were in gym shorts all week.
In a scenario-based approach, if you are designing a very high-risk project on the course, you might want to look at those higher numbers.
And on the flip side, of course, if you're building something that's not too expensive to replace, or the world doesn't end if it breaks, in that scenario, you might be able to save some money and build for the lower sea level rise numbers, and you can fix it later if you have to.
Planning and thinking about sea level rise and snake eyes with loaded dice. Kenny Malone, thank you for the insights.
Thanks, Tom.
There are plenty of charts, graphs, animations, and other representations hinting at what South Florida could look like in 25 or even 100 years in the future. But Mother Nature already offers a vivid preview of what may come. As reporter Christine DiMattei tells us, a tidal phenomenon is showing us what sea level rise might do to our coastal areas in just a few decades.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, what we're going to do here today is I'm going to ask the homeowners to take positions at their homes.
About 2 dozen people are here at the Delray Beach Marina Historic District for a little walking tour. The houses along the Intracoastal Waterway represent a mix of different styles, with stately two-story colonial revivals interspersed among the quaint bungalows. But very little mention is made of history or architecture. Instead, the homeowners tell the tour group about the havoc that periodic flooding is wreaking on their properties.
We've lost washers and dryers. I've had to clean out the gas hot water heater every year because the water floods in.
Just one day earlier, ocean water sloshing over the dock or gushing up through storm drains made some streets along the tour path nearly impassable. The massive flooding wasn't caused by a tropical storm or other rain event, but by one of the highest tides of the year, nicknamed King Tide. And Charles Dortch says the tour was scheduled to coincide with it.
Visuals are everything. The water will actually help us to tell the story.
Dortch is vice president of the Historic District's Homeowners Association. And the story the King Tide flooding is laying out so starkly is how sea level rise will one day transform this neighborhood.
We can ignore it, and then we're going to see this increasingly get worse over the years, or we can acknowledge it's happening.
A king tide occurs several times a year when the moon and sun align with the earth. Such tides last for several days and are anywhere between a few inches and several feet higher than normal. During this king tide, many of South Florida's coastal communities were swamped. Miami Beach pedestrians were forced to wade through nearly knee-deep seawater in some sections. In Fort Lauderdale, water crept up to the very steps of the Stranahan House along the New River.
You get sort of a glimpse into the future of what coastal flooding will start to look like as the sea level rise issue becomes more prominent.
Dr. Anna Pushkin-Shevlin is an urban planning consultant based in Delray Beach. She says King Tide flooding serves as a wake-up call for coastal communities.
We saw the waters come up and cover the streets and flood the lawns, and this only happened for an hour or two during the high tide. But eventually, this will become a norm.
In recent years, state lawmakers have taken steps to help local governments plan and pay for the impacts of sea level rise. In 2011, the Florida legislature passed a law allowing counties to identify so-called adaptation action areas, vulnerable places that would get first priority for funding. But for now, the homeowners in Delray's Marina Historic District are pretty much on their own when it comes to upgrading their properties to withstand the onslaught of the rising waters. Charles Dortch says he hopes his neighbors can get some help with that.
Mother Nature is not going to stop just because we say stop, you cannot pass. And we have to try to put into play things that will make it easier for us to live here while this is happening, at least sometime into the future.
Thank you. That concludes our tour. If you have some questions, we have some experts here. That
reporting from Delray Beach, I'm Christine DiMattei.
Streets you can repair or even move, but there are some consequences of sea level rise that are more permanent. Big Pine Key takes its name from the pine forests that cover or covered the island, lying about 30 miles from Key West. Rare plants and endangered animals like the key deer live in those forests. But now those forests and hammocks are threatened by rising seas around and beneath them. Nancy Klingener reports.
Robert Ehrig points to a piece of land that was hardwood hammock when he came to live here 35 years ago.
All the palms in here are dead. The last one died about the time of Hurricane Wilma, about 7-8 years ago, maybe right after. Those palm trees were 8-10 feet tall, which means they were 70 to 100 years old because they're very slow-growing species, and they died simply because of the prolonged tides.
Big Pine Key has pine forests and hardwood hammocks because it sits on a freshwater lens. They need that freshwater to survive. The island is made of limestone, which holds rainwater, almost like a sponge, but that sponge is porous to all kinds of water. Chris Berg is the South Florida Conservation Director for the Nature Conservancy, and he lives on Big Pine.
So as the sea rises, the freshwater is pushed out by saltwater. As the sea rises, the island itself becomes smaller. And as the sea rises, the freshwater-dependent species start to give way. They start to lose the battle between themselves and the saltwater-tolerant species like mangroves.
Berg says sea level rise affects islands like Big Pine differently from mainland South Florida.
Not only as the sea rises does it come in from every direction, from north, south, east, and west, but it also comes up from beneath. It comes up through the ground itself. And the salt water actually moves up through the rock, bubbling up, so to speak, from below.
And that's why the pines of Big Pine Key are disappearing. Despite the changes he sees on his land, Robert Ehrig says in some ways, it's still the quiet rural island he discovered back in the 70s.
I remember coming to Florida after being in Hawaii and the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and Central America and being kind of disappointed until I got to the Keys, because then I was out of the country again.
Back then, high tides would cover his property maybe 5 times a year. Now, he says it's more like 30. His land is now dotted with the skeletons of trees like slash pine, poisonwood, and varnishwood. In their place, red mangroves are thriving because they do really well in salt water.
What's happened here is the natural history is really changing. And it's changing rapidly, and for a number of reasons, but probably the most pronounced reason is sea level rise.
Big Pine, like all the Florida Keys, was created by the sea. It's the sea that draws the people who choose to make their lives here, and the sea that shaped the land. The sea is still altering the landscape, changing the ecosystem before our eyes. We notice when a storm surge covers the island, but you have to live here for a while to see the rhythmic, repeated tides that are washing ever higher over the land, and the retreat of the pine forests, leaving a monoculture of mangroves in their wake. I'm Nancy Klingener on Big Pine Key.
Up next on Elevation Zero, rising seas in South Florida, how the message and threat of higher seas is communicated from politics to art. This is Elevation Zero, rising seas in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. We'll explain this music in a moment. Sea level has risen about 9 inches since the 1920s, according to data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. How much higher seas will rise and how fast is much more difficult to determine exactly. That's the nature of scientific predictions. The uncertainty of the pace and extent has meant no clear universal list of priorities or policies. WLRN's Ariana Prothero and Wilson Sayre join me now. Ari, what agencies really seem to be driving the official governmental discussion when it comes to rising seas?
Well, a lot of agencies will say they do plan for sea level rise because they have a general policy to plan for the future. However, there are some agencies that have really been proactive in terms of setting a specific policy. One example being the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, largely because they have to. The Corps deals in water resources, infrastructure, such as, you know, dams and levees, that sort of thing. So they have had a pretty robust policy to deal with sea level rise since 2009 and really have been leading that charge.
Wilson, how does this impact then policymaking at the local level and at the state level?
Well, with regard to major infrastructure, there's definitely a distinction between state policy or lack of statewide policy and local policy when it comes to making sure that we're shoring up our buildings and our roads. And it's great that municipalities are taking steps to plan for the future. But there's kind of two issues here. One is the way that municipalities have implemented their policy. It's more like goals and stipulations, like Ari was saying. It's these long-term desires. The second issue is that a lot of the infrastructure is state. And so there's not a lot that cities can do. The DOT has been great in working with Fort Lauderdale, especially with the A1A. But the goal of many South Florida towns is to protect the infrastructure before it gets destroyed.
Ari, what's the benefit of having a definitive policy like the Corps has for projects that come under its umbrella?
Well, I mean, first off, it would make our buildings and roads and whatnot, it would make sure they are planned and built for rising sea levels. And that really saves money in the long run. It is a lot more cost effective to be proactive rather than reactive, meaning that it's a lot more cost effective. It saves you money if you build and plan for rising seas before that infrastructure is taken out by sea level rise or damaged by sea level rise or other things that are exacerbated or made worse by sea level rise. Two examples of that would be, you know, New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina or the Northeast and New Jersey and New York after Hurricane Sandy. It would have saved them, a lot of studies have shown, that would have saved local governments a lot more money and the federal government a lot more money if they had fortified major infrastructure against sea level rise and worse storm surge from sea level rise before this infrastructure was damaged or taken out by Hurricane Sandy.
Policymaking can be a lot about politicking, Wilson. Are those two getting tied up? In other words, is the policy of trying to address rising sea level getting tied up in the politics of climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of the reason people have said that there's no statewide policy is because it's not been on the front burner for Governor Rick Scott. And as you say, it is a very political issue. We see sea level rise happening now. You'd kind of be blind not to see it. But when we get to the part about how we should respond to it, we inevitably get drawn back into that political conflict because it gets back to the root cause of sea level rise.
You guys have looked at two examples of the uncertainty over rules, over how to respond to the threat of higher seas with policies. Rebuilding the portion of A1A that fell into the ocean when Hurricane Sandy passed by about a year ago, 200 miles offshore, and fixing the sewer system in Miami-Dade County.
Rising sea levels pose big problems for the infrastructure in coastal communities. For example, sea level rise could mean bigger storm surges during hurricanes. Albert Slapp is a lawyer representing the local environmental group Biscayne Bay Waterkeeper. He says when a wastewater treatment plant is overrun by storm surge, the outcome can be extremely messy.
When Hurricane Sandy hit, it knocked out many sewage treatment plants in New Jersey and in New York and caused the discharge of over 11 billion gallons of raw sewage.
Biscayne Bay Waterkeeper is suing the county over the deal it's worked out with the EPA. One reason? Sea level rise is not included in the repair plans for the county's three wastewater treatment plants. The county's oldest plant is about 60 years old. It sits on Virginia Key, a small, unprotected barrier island. So it doesn't smell that bad here.
Treatment plant's working today.
Doug Yoder is the deputy director of the Miami-Dade Water and Sewer Department. Yoder says the county will still fortify its wastewater treatment plants against rising waters, even though that's not explicitly written into its agreement with the EPA, called a consent decree.
EPA has no specific requirements, no rules associated with sea level rise or climate change.
According to Yoder, the EPA does have a set of recommendations for preparing for rising seas. So too does the Southeast Regional Climate Change Compact, which Florida's four Southeast counties belong to. But recommendations are a far cry from policy that carries penalties for inaction. If this project fell under another federal agency, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the situation would be very different. The Corps' current policy, which dates back to 2009, requires its projects to be designed to withstand rising sea levels. The Corps' Kathleen White says the failure of the agency's levee system around New Orleans during Katrina pushed it to develop a more robust policy for rising seas. She thinks Hurricane Sandy may do the same for the rest of the country because of where it came ashore.
The economic implications of Sandy expanded far beyond the Northeast. For Sandy, it said, for every $1 spent on the coastal storm risk infrastructure now could have saved over $12 if it had been spent before Sandy.
State and local governments don't have to wait for the feds to take action, though. That's according to Daniel Suman with the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science.
I think we have some good examples regarding air pollution and carbon reduction programs in some states because we don't have action at the federal level, but yet California has taken some steps and is really leading the national effort now.
But in absence of strict rules, what happens? The Florida Department of Transportation is revamping a major thoroughfare in Miami Beach, Alton Road. That agency's project includes sea level rise projections in its design plans. But Albert Slapp says Biscayne Bay Waterkeeper wants a guarantee.
We want the protections built into the decree and enforceable in federal court. We don't want to just take the county's word for it.
If there's no settlement, the trial is scheduled to begin in January. I'm Ariana Prothero in Miami.
I'm Wilson Sayre. Back in November of last year, Tropical Storm Sandy washed out a four-block section of State Road A1A in Fort Lauderdale, just north of Sunrise Boulevard. Along the beach is a low corrugated wall with a makeshift wooden cover on top. The road is a patchwork of different shades of asphalt, but beyond that, you'd never know that a year ago it was all underwater.
My neighbors would come down and have a glass of wine on my patio out there, and we'd watch the kayakers coming down the middle of A1A.
Molly Myers has been in the same house since eighth grade. She's seen the water come across the road before, lapping up against the seawall that separates her house from A1A. But the destruction of last year was a first.
I'd never seen it come across the way it did that time, again and again and again.
The waves from Sandy and some small storms just after ate away at the sand, causing sections of road and sidewalk to fall into the sea, like piano keys or falling dominoes. But remember, Sandy wasn't a big storm. To explain the uncharacteristic destruction, many pointed to sea level rise. Len Berry is director of the Center for Environmental Studies at FAU.
In many parts of the globe, 6 inches sea level rise doesn't make much difference. In South Florida, it does.
When the waters retreated, the city started to rebuild the road in the same place. There really was no other choice. It's the only road that accesses some 150 homes and condos there, a situation that's repeated throughout coastal areas in South Florida. In February, the Florida Department of Transportation drove 44-foot sheet pilings into the sand between the beach and what was left of the road. It's a long-term solution, something that other roads in South Florida, just as vulnerable, just as crucial, have yet to benefit from. Scott Peterson is the FDOT project manager for the A1A reconstruction.
The sheet pile will protect all the infrastructure landward of that sheet piling.
But experts are critical of FDOT's tendency to react instead of prevent when it comes to the effects of sea level rise.
DOT has been good at getting some of the issues studied. They haven't been able to follow up in implementing much.
That's Len Berry again. He was principal investigator on one study funded by FDOT. It lays out a method for identifying areas that will be affected by sea level rise. But FDOT has yet to turn it into any sort of policy. Policy, of course, is one way of setting priorities, goals, and mandates, both in design and budgeting.
It's not something that's risen to the level yet that the department feels that we have to set a statewide policy on this issue yet.
Jim Wood is director of policy at FDOT. He thinks studies like Barry's are excellent tools for municipalities as they deal with sea level rise.
But the department is not setting a specific policy moving forward that this is how it will be have to be implemented.
He says it doesn't necessarily make sense for the department to set policy for something that would be of more interest to South Florida than elsewhere in the state. Cities like Fort Lauderdale can and are taking initiative, though, in shoring up infrastructure despite the lack of statewide policy. Diana Alarcone is from the Fort Lauderdale Transportation and Mobility Department.
it's very near and dear to our heart to put best practices into place so that we are creating the roadways for not just tomorrow, but for, you know, 20 years down the road.
They've already spent over $8 million, with at least another $6 million to go. The plan for the washout section of A1A reduces the four lanes to two. It's a symbol of what Barry calls retreat. Though the word is not in the American lexicon, he says it will have to be as we deal with the future of sea level rise. I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
Having an official policy is a clear signal to everyone involved what the rules are, but pages and pages of regulatory policy can be dense and, quite frankly, boring. This music, the music you've heard during this segment, is one man's attempt to give the changing environment a melody, a tone, a timbre. Composer Carson Kiefman wrote his Symphony No. 4, Biodiversity, as a reflection on the fragility of the natural world in light of challenges such as sea level rise. The symphony begins in the glaciers, glissandi of melted runoff turn into movement two, the Great Swamp, one of which is in our backyard. This is the fourth movement, The Year of the Reef. This is a digitally performed version of the symphony, but Sobey Institute of the Arts is working to produce a recording of the live symphony. The National Park Service has asked Kiefman to perform the piece with local orchestras in parks across the country to raise awareness of environmental issues such as rising seas. WLRN's Rick Stone looks at how our brains are wired and how we respond to dire but distant threats.
A decade ago, sea level rise from climate change was a political argument with very little external reality in the minds of most people. But University of Miami professor Kenny Broad might have said then what he says right now.
This isn't some distant future generation problem. It's in our lap right now, and we don't have a lot of time to make some key decisions.
Broad is an environmental anthropologist connected to UM's Climate and Marine Sciences School, but he's also a co-director of Columbia University's Center for Research on Environmental Decisions. CRED, as it's called, studies the human mind.
To understand how people respond to perceive the risk associated with climate change and other environmental challenges.
Spoiler alert, we are not good at it. We don't care about things that are far away in time and distance. Our attention spans are short. And we have this bias for small-scale responses that stop the worry but extinguish further concern, like buying low-wattage light bulbs while the North Pole melts. But we can be reached. A movie called The Day After Tomorrow was released in 2004. It imagined all the evil effects of climate change happening on one terrible afternoon.
New York City. Come on!
Your best chance is to stay inside. Pray.
In the movie, people got together in a movement to address the situation.
I have a problem for you.
Narrative and unified action are powerful motivators, according to the principles of decision science. Broad says a study found a post-day after tomorrow spike in concern about climate change. It lasted about 6 months. Parrots chatter over the stylish shoppers at Miami Beach's outdoor Lincoln Road Mall, which in 30 years or so may have to be renamed the Lincoln Road Canal.
Everything will be under 3 feet of water to the west of us.
Meet Heidi Quanta. She's doing the advance work for a performance art project that she thinks will keep sea level rise at the top of South Florida's collective mind. Like that Day After Tomorrow movie, it'll provide a narrative and collective action, but it will rely also on another tenet of decision science, how people learn.
When you look at what's most effective, it's curiosity-driven self-learning. And it's through things that are odd and unique.
Quanta and her group, led by New York artist Eve Mosher, have assembled volunteers and gotten grants to draw chalk lines around the new boundaries between water and land, given a South Florida sea level rise of 3 feet. There will be a chalking event in Miami Beach and another in Miami. It's called the High Waterline Project.
A lot of the public in Miami is not aware of sea level rise and how it will impact their beloved city. But the moment they become aware, the passion to learn more is fierce.
Volunteers pushing athletic field chalkers will be following a map that Florida International University geographer Matthew Toro made with data from NASA and other federal sources. It shows the effect of various levels of sea level rise. Toro found the work sobering.
You see on these maps
the water world that we are entering into. You know, my son, I have a young boy, he's in second grade. He'll be living in a community that's where high-level flooding is a regular occurrence.
People who watch the chalkers go by, drawing the new shoreline through front yards, playgrounds, and business districts, will be the taxpayers and voters who must consent to the sea-level action plans that local governments are developing. First, they'll have to determine whether the threat is real and imminent, and that will call for some decisions. I'm Rick Stone in Miami.
Chalk lines, music, movies. Now, can you imagine Lincoln Road as Lincoln Canal? Is this the future we should embrace instead of fight? Up next on Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida, the response and reaction. This is Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. South Florida is not the only place suffering from and facing the risk of sea level rise. Several of the island nations making up the Caribbean region are on the front edge of the threat. The Caribbean Basin is important not just for the white sands and blue surf, but as a strategic hemispheric crossroads. From the Bahamas to Belize, from Grenada to Guyana, scientists say rising seawaters could do more than ruin the crucial tourism industry. They could leave some islands virtually uninhabitable if major preventative measures aren't taken soon. Tim Padgett takes us on a tour of what is happening in this threatened piece of paradise.
Ulrich Trotz is deputy director of the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center in Belize.
In 50 years, if the projections that we are seeing from our models are correct, then the entire landscape will be changed. Our beaches would have disappeared, our coastal areas eroded, our infrastructure degraded. Certainly would wreak havoc on the way we live.
Experts project the Caribbean faces sea level rise of 3 to 6 feet or more by the end of this century. If it goes unchecked, they fear as much as 1,200 square miles of coastal land could be lost. A recent Inter-American Development Bank report that Trotz co-authored estimates half the Caribbean community's major tourist resorts could be damaged or destroyed by sea rise, surge, or erosion, not to mention scores of sea turtle nesting beaches.
All of the physical plants supporting the tourism industry, hotels, airports, would be in what we call the inundation zone.
The Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, started sounding the sea level rise alarm in the early 1990s. Today, it's recommending that the basin nations begin erecting more than 200 miles of levees and seawalls at a cost of almost $6 billion. Problem is, the Caribbean doesn't have that kind of cash in the best of times, and these aren't the best of times. In fact, the Caribbean is currently home to 5 of the world's 12 most indebted countries. Kenrick Leslie is the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center's director.
It will be extremely difficult for us to put in place the type of adaptation measures that we have recognized would be necessary.
The Caribbean islands and the 40 million people who live on them produce less than 1% of the greenhouse gases that many scientists blame for the global warming that's causing rising sea levels. As a result, the basin's leaders say developed nations should help finance the Caribbean mitigation tab.
We are not looking for hands out. We are looking for concessional loans. When we go to the international meetings, we try to make it very clear. We need to have programs supported by the larger industrialized countries.
Coastal tourism isn't the only concern. Further inland, agriculture and freshwater supplies are also threatened by more intense storm and tidal surges.
Some islands, some of the smaller low-lying islands may actually have to be evacuated.
Brian Soden is a professor of meteorology and physical oceanography at the University of Miami. And like other scientists, he believes the Bahama Islands, just off South Florida, are some of the most vulnerable. Many of the Caribbean's eastern islands were formed volcanically and have a bit more elevated breathing room, but western isles like the Bahamas chain are just downright flat.
A vast amount of their acreage is literally within 2 or 3 feet of sea level. That's well within the range of projected sea level rise over the next century.
But whether it's the Bahamas or Barbados, Caribbean sea level rise may well result in a spike in immigration, especially to South Florida. And none of that seems fair to a region that stands to suffer the most from a phenomenon that it's done the least to provoke. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Sea level rise is a multi-decade challenge. It's a challenge that will stretch over generations. Florida public schools are not required to teach about the effects of climate change, like sea level rise, until high school. But in South Florida, Many students learn about the changing environment well before then. They see it in their neighborhoods and at their schools. WLRN State Impact Florida's Sammy Mack reports about the children who live and learn at Elevation Zero.
When Alejandra Andevert Seaman was in third grade, she ran for class president on a campaign of sea turtles. When she won, she followed through on her campaign promise. She helped her class adopt 3 sea turtles.
A Marmalade, and Turtley, and Toby.
These days, the 9-year-old resident of Miami Beach is concerned about sea level rise.
Sea level rise? It's like from all the ice from Atlanta and from the pollution, and the ice is all breaking down, so all the animals are dying that are from the ice. Our land, it'll be almost all water.
You don't want to scare kids, but at the same time, you want them to become aware of things.
Kirk Naveen is a curriculum support specialist for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. The state doesn't require students learn about climate change until high school, but Miami-Dade starts teaching local climate science as early as elementary school. Naveen points out South Florida kids observe sea level rise all around them, on television, online, and also in person, like the unusually high tides that have been flooding Miami Beach. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the sea level in Miami has risen more than 9 inches in the past 100 years, and scientists expect a lot more in the next 100. Naveen wants to give students a framework to connect and explain what they see around them with what they've learned in school.
That's one of the things that we push here specifically in the district as well with the Common Core state standards, is that we're really pushing for that argumentative piece within science of, okay, this is what your claim is. What evidence do you have that backs up that claim? And then how can you bring the scientific reasoning into that?
Miami-Dade County alone has 66 schools that offer environmental or marine sciences. There are 13 magnet schools focused on the environment, like the Mast Magnet School on Florida International University's Biscayne Bay campus.
The crabs are tiny. They're frightened of you. They're not going to follow you home and kill you in sleep.
Miguel Fernandez is preparing his 9th grade marine biology class to muck around mangrove roots and harvest seedlings. They'll eventually be replanted in a mangrove restoration project at the university.
Oh! Look at that! Big spider!
It's part of a lesson on ecology and biodiversity.
It's a golden orb spider, and they can't hurt you.
While his classmates dodge spiders and duck in and out of mangrove roots, 15-year-old Corbin Bolas tries to imagine what the waterline will look like in the future.
By the time my children have their own children, coastlines could be gone.
Mary Kreider designed a sea level rise curriculum for the Arthur R. Marshall Foundation, a nonprofit that educates around 25,000 students a year about the Everglades.
This next generation, to get them outside, is something that we think is really important.
Kreider says partnerships between public schools and other institutions, like the mangrove restoration, can empower young people like Corbin and Alejandra to act on sea level rise and not feel so overwhelmed that they just shut down.
There's kind of phases that they go through when they get all this information. And the first one is kind of just, oh my gosh, this is going to happen. I think I'll just ignore it. And then the next phase, they're like, okay, I think I kind of can absorb this information. But now what can I do?
Corbin Bolas can't remember when he first learned about sea level rise. It's just part of his life. But knowing he can do something about it gives him measured optimism.
I feel hopeful, but I am worried that based on how humans are acting now, that we will progress into a more disastrous level of sea rise.
For State Impact Florida, I'm Sammy Mack.
At the end of the road in South Florida lies Key West, mile marker 0. It's also one of the most vulnerable places in South Florida to rising seas. Here's NPR's Greg Allen.
There's a new firehouse under construction in Key West, and it's being built with sea level rise in mind.
The Stock Island Fire Station is going to be developed at a finished floor elevation of 10 feet, which will be 1 foot above the FEMA floodplain level.
Project manager Johnny Young says that's a foot higher than originally planned. The firehouse's living quarters were raised even more, 1.5 feet. Plans were rewritten to elevate the building after the county adopted a new action plan for climate change. Under the firehouse's front steps, Project Superintendent Buddy Montgomery says there's something else.
Right here, you're standing on top of a cistern right here.
Just as in the old days, new homes and businesses built in Key West will soon need cisterns. They're reservoirs that hold rainwater, in this case, 22,000 gallons collected from roofs and downspouts.
So every drop that hits that roof will be going in there. It goes through a filtration system and then into the cistern.
It's water for use in gardens, swimming pools, and toilets. And by collecting rainwater, cisterns help reduce flooding by keeping it out of the streets. Under ordinances recently adopted in Key West, all new buildings will have to meet these same requirements. They'll have to be raised at least a foot and a half higher than the current standard, use green building codes, and have large freshwater cisterns.
We live on an island, a 2.5 by 3.5 mile island, completely surrounded by water.
Donald Craig is the city's planning director.
We are connected to the mainland by a thin thread of US 1 and a pipeline that travels 154 miles to South Florida for our water. We are, in all senses of the word, vulnerable to sea level rise.
Building up, like the new fire station in Key West, and building on stilts is something that has a history here and maybe a future. Dr. Antonio Nani is a structural engineer professor at the University of Miami. One idea he dreamed up may be extreme, but just listen.
I think, for example, it's not unconceivable today to think of South Beach as the Venice of the 21st century. Now I'm dreaming even beyond my technological abilities, but for example, we could even decide that some of the streets that we have now, think of Lincoln Road, for example, to make it a beautiful canal. So all of a sudden, we start digging up what used to be a road. We can use that material as infill to rise the level of new construction, and all of a sudden, we have a beautiful waterway that allows us for not only transportation, but attract more tourists.
Instead of fighting, maybe embracing the threat. The responses to rising seas range from reinforcement to retreat. There are efforts to mitigate, reduce the risk of higher seas, and there are adaptations, ways to accept it, live with it. We go back to Sunset Harbor on Miami Beach with Brian Norcross.
It's a wonderful place to live near the water, but living near the water means adjusting to that. And we've started to do that. We're going to do it more, adjusting to the hurricanes of the future and the sea level rise reality.
This is Elevation Zero, Rising Seas in South Florida. The program was produced by Wilson Sayre. For the entire WLRN Miami Herald News team, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.